I'm not going to read the texts this morning because we have read them several times. This is the final week in our lesson, The Abuse of Power. We have talked about these texts extensively. If you missed one of the weeks, you might have missed the final one that is a text from the book of Proverbs, but it was quoted by Paul in Romans 12. We've been talking about power. We've been talking about what Jesus has to say about power. And in the examination of several of these things that Jesus had to say, we've come upon these scriptures that are very familiar in Western society because they've been around for a long, long time. For 2,000 years, we have honored these teachings as holy. We have recognized that they have a place in the pantheon of the highest of spiritual truths. And to our credit, we do much better at heeding them than we have done in the past. History seems to indicate that we are better now than we used to be at seeing how connected we are all one to another. We do better now than we used to at seeing that the circles to which we belong are actually bigger circles than we at first imagined. We are better today than we used to be at trying to understand our enemy than we used to be. But for all the progress that we have made, in no way are we human beings, or even we Christians, good at it yet. We're much better than we used to be, we're just not good at it yet, because it is very difficult to hear and to heed these teachings of Jesus, and we talked extensively about why and how that is the case. At the most elemental level of our being, our view of reality is skewed. We've said common sense tends to disserve us. We feel more separate from one another than we really are. The circles to which we belong are much larger than we think they are. Well, today I want to conclude this lesson on the misuse and often the abuse of power by looking at one more way in which we tend to undercut our capacity to hear and heed the teachings of Jesus. Now, next week, I'll begin a new lesson, and it will be about how to move forward and to use power effectively. We'll look at a different set of the teachings of Jesus. I want to conclude today by looking at this one, this critical one. And it is the power that we wield over others when we name them. The powers that we wield over one another when we name one another. If somebody asks you who you are, what do you say? You would typically respond with some kind of a descriptive label. I am a parent, I have two kids, or I'm a grandparent, I have five grandkids, or I'm a husband, or I'm a wife, or I'm a student, or I'm a friend, or I'm a worker, or I work with my hands, or I work with a computer, or I'm this color, I'm this race, I'm white, I'm black, I'm brown, I'm Republican, I'm Democrat, I'm Christian, I'm agnostic, I do sports, I watch sports, I like boating, I like to play cards. We report the things that a video camera could capture if it was following us around, seeing us do the things that we do, and we would name that a label, and then we would name ourselves with that label. And then as we get older, perhaps as we get wiser, we begin to think of ourselves more in interior terms, and so we might report when someone asks us who we are, this is the way my brain works. I am task-oriented, or I am people-oriented, or I'm driven, or I'm laid back, or I just can't stand incompetence, that's just who I am, or I can't stand mean people, that's just who I am. I'm spiritual, or I'm not spiritual. I'm virtuous, or I'm not virtuous. I'm honest and reliable and caring, or I'm lazy, I indulge my tastes too much, I'm a bit selfish, I care about other people, you know what, I really don't care about other people, I care about the planet, I don't care about the planet, I care about my nation, I don't care about my nation, and each one of these descriptors, each one of these external and internal labels that we assign to ourselves names something about us that we do, or something that we think, or something that we feel, and this serves to be how we define us. It's a physical or relational description of our work, our personality, our character, and after we accumulate enough of these descriptive labels, if we dig deeply enough and gather the most accurate ones, then what we do is we report them to one another, and when I have given you my labels, I have given you me. That's it. That's me, that collection of labels. And so then, after I have cataloged these series of labels for myself, I turn around and begin to gather and catalog descriptive labels of you. And for every other person that I know or that I interact with, and they're conservative, and so I compare and contrast. You know, by comparison, I'm not conservative, I'm liberal. And they're a woman, by comparison and contrast, I'm a man. Or this person is compassionate, so by comparison and contrast, I'm not as compassionate as that person, or I'm more compassionate than that person, or he is a nosy guy, he's a selfish guy, he's a snobby guy. Phew, I'm not nearly as nosy or as selfish or as snobby as that. And we label one another and then compare labels. It's like baseball cards. We put them out on the table and we see who each other are. And this labeling strategy, the next thing that we do after I have cataloged a series of labels about me and I cataloged a series of labels about you and I compare and contrast them together, then the next thing I do is begin to take a shorthand approach to that because that's really hard to do. So I will shorthand things, especially when I relate to you, by defining you not by many labels, but often by a single label. And I will have one label that I put as shorthand way of identifying you and determining how I will relate to you. Oftentimes it can be a racial identifier. You are this color, I am that color. Or it can be a political identifier, or it can be a job one, or a sexual orientation one, or a strength, or a disability, and I will choose, of the many labels that you carry, one of those, and that becomes everything I need to know to tell me everything I need to know about you. And often this single descriptor, this single label, is all we need to decide how we feel about someone, because we lump lots of someones together into these categories. So once I label my husband as uncaring, and I put him into that box, and I put a label on that box, then I can do two things. I can relate to him through the lens of his uncaringness, and I can ignore the many other labels that also might apply to him, let alone the idea that we'll see in a moment that as human beings, we can't be limited to labels or descriptors at all. And this human tendency, this tendency to name someone with a descriptive label and then relate to that person through the lens of that simplified version of the label, well, this gives naming a tremendous amount of power. It gives labeling a tremendous amount of power, and we do it all the time. It's just that we don't think about it very much. We do it without considering it very deeply. When I pull up to the fast food window, and I hear the accent of the person that's working there, I pull out a label and I use it, oftentimes not even thinking about it. When I see the clothes that someone wears, I define that by a label, and it tells me what I need to know to relate to that person. When I see someone being portrayed on the nightly news and the words and the vocabulary that is used to describe what they have done, then I know exactly how to think about them and relate to them. And when a loved one makes a shift from nurturing and befriending and being nice to us to hurting us and wounding us and being not nice to us, then I have a label, and I can put that label on to that person and relate to them accordingly. And when we put this name on someone, when we put this label on someone, the name begins to take on a power of its own because it enters into our minds, and the minds of those that we name it enters into, and it creates a lens through which we view one another and through which we view ourselves. And the power of naming is even stronger when we buy somebody else's label or somebody else's name for us. I am lazy, just like Dad said I was, and sure enough, that will have a tremendous amount of power on me. Just like the teacher said, everybody says so, the label must be me, and so I buy the name, I buy the label, I buy into laziness, and it becomes, in some ways, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Instead of seeing my laziness as not yet having found the passion of my heart, or instead of seeing what was labeled laziness as a limited supply of physical energy, it's the me that I buy into, it's the me that defines me. And this one's even worse because I didn't even get to define it. Somebody else defined it for me. So, all that to say, we should be very careful about the labels that we allow to be assigned to ourselves, and we should be very careful about the labels that we assigned to one another. We should ask ourselves if this description is large enough to contain this whole person. Whenever you find yourself saying something like, you always do this, or you never do that, there's a good chance that your label is not expansive enough because nobody always does anything. Nobody never does something. We usually define ourselves by too limited a label, and one of the keys to seeing that we've done that is always or never. Sometimes everybody buying the limiting label brings us to this place where we can't help but experience the shrinking of our souls. Other times we don't buy somebody else's label for it, we resist it or we fight against it, and in the process we begin creating counter labels that are just as shrinking. So we would come along and say, oh, he's just a workaholic, you can't count on him. Or she's just emotional, you don't have to pay too much attention to her. And when we put those labels out, it determines what happens from that point on. And now he is shrunken to being a workaholic, and she is shrunken to be overly emotional. And the interactions that we can possibly have together are shrunken to relate only according to that label, that name. Being limited by labels does tend to cause conflict, the kind of conflicts that we've been talking about in this lesson. Because what it does is labeling one another tends to spawn a competitive environment. And so consequently, if you are labeled as this, then I am labeled as less of that if it's bad, or I am labeled as more of this if it's good, because that way when we get to the point where we can compete with one another, I come out on top. Well, this kind of environment creates the world in which everybody is working for a win, as we talked about 2 weeks ago. The idea of win-lose gets stuck into our brains that our relationships have to be determined according to win-lose interactions. The idea of win-win interactions begins to be more and more elusive because we can't work toward a more comprehensive solution because we have labeled. And then we, by labeling, have limited. So we should be very careful about the names to which we assent, and we should be very careful about the names that we give to one another. It serves us well to think larger. It serves us well to examine these, to look at what's going on tacitly when we name, because as I said, most of the time we name, we're not thinking, I'm going to come up with a name for you, and this is it. Most of the time it just happens in response to a knee-jerk emotional response. You've said something mean to you, instantaneously I label you, and from that point on I am stuck living within the parameters of that label. So we should examine our labels. We should bring them from the tacit to the explicit. We should consider them carefully. We should look at them. What label do you default to when you interact with the irritating guy at work? What label have you unconsciously assigned to him? Perhaps he's just dumb. And so I just don't pay much attention to him because he's stupid. He says the craziest things and he's socially inappropriate and he does this thing again and again. So he doesn't seem to have any class. So the best thing you could do is just navigate a wide berth around him, stay away, because that's the only thing you can do with people who are dumb. Or what label do you assign to someone when they are poor? Perhaps that label has been unconsciously assigned that says, well, the poor are just lazy. They had the opportunity, they just didn't take it. Or the poor are unvirtuous. They are poor because they have a character flaw. They're not industrious or they're not diligent. Or the poor are poor because they are content to be where they are. If they had any more gumption, they would have just got up and done something about it. And we've got a label that we put on someone, and it would be good for us to examine those labels. And the names that we assign to people, the names that we assign to ourselves, determine what we're going to do next. They determine how we're going to respond, how we're going to solve our problems, what kind of problems we're going to be looking to solve, what problems we're going to leave unsolved. It's going to determine the energy level that we bring to a problem. It's going to determine the passion that we bring to a problem. It's going to determine how we act, respond, and think. If the name that we have afforded to a friend is he's totally self-absorbed, then it doesn't make much sense to work toward a reciprocating relationship in which we both share our lives deeply, because that's not what people do when they are totally self-absorbed. He or she won't be open to it. The name that I have given to him or to her tells me so. But if we would hear and heed the words of Jesus, we're going to have to work on our labels, because totally self-absorbed is deterministic. I'm only going to do one thing, and it's not love my neighbor with the same passion with which I love myself. If this person is labeled totally self-absorbed, I'm only going to do one thing in response to that, and it's not to feed my enemy when he is hungry. Because once we have a label locked in our heads, sure as shootin', you're going to find out that that person is going to act just like the label that you gave them. The guy at work is going to say something off point, and he is going to do something that looks very dumb. The friend is going to do something selfish and totally self-absorbed, and you will have no recourse at that moment but to reinforce the name that you have given that person, to be offended, to quietly confirm to yourself your wise and discerning judgment that you have made about this person. Your judgment is confirmed. The label that you gave to that person is accurate. It is him. The label that I gave to her is her. What else could it be? And now I can be smug and self-satisfied, and I can just sit here in the limitation of possibilities that I've imposed upon myself and feel really good about me. But that limits the reality that we live in, and it limits the possibilities before us. Because let's just say that you do have a friend who is extraordinarily selfish. Within that labeling construct that I just described, where is the motivation to help that person move from their selfishness? Within that construct, where does it exist that we can help the person who is socially inept move into a place of greater connectedness and greater absorption into the community? When we're self-satisfied with the limiting and limited names that we apply to others and to ourselves, where is the incentive to make a better world? Where is the incentive to make a world in which neighbors do carry one another, in which enemies do forgive one another? Because in this world, where we have labeled and we are satisfied with our labels, there's no puzzling over how it is that I'm going to help that person be less selfish. There's no puzzling over how I can help that person fit in better. There's no puzzling over how it is that I can help draw forth from someone a truer version of their made in the image of God self. There's no motivation to cover over someone's weakness while we are waiting for the truer self to emerge. Because once we've assigned that label, the label is him or is her. And now the world is reduced to a series of interactions that are the kinds of interactions you have with label people. I'm relating to Mr. Boorish Lout right now. And what else can I do? I have no recourse but to roll my eyes, to be irritated, and to give him a wide berth. Because that's what you do with Boorish Louts. I'm relating to Ms. Selfish Prima Donna, and I have no recourse but to watch her with silent criticism, because that's what you do with selfish prima donnas. And the label with which I've named them leaves me no other alternative. So when we are lazy in assigning our labels, when we name someone according to a limiting trait, it makes the descriptor of them that we assign to them the only definition of them. And when we do that, we shrink our worlds, we shrink the possibilities, we shrink other people, and we shrink our own souls. So it's a good idea to give careful thought and consideration to our descriptors. It's a good idea to expand the horizon of how we see and how we define people. I worked my way through college in a grocery store. And I worked with a guy who was really grouchy every day. We had to get up at 5 a.m. every day and come stack shelves at the grocery store, put cans on shelves. Maybe that had something to do with why he was so grouchy. But his job was to oversee this little area of the grocery department, and he oversaw it like a petty tyrant. Anybody who had to work with him was cursed. And he was several years older than me, and he was the defining nature of curmudgeon. And there's 40 or 50 people who made up this small working community of people in this grocery store, and among all of them, he had a reputation, and I wasn't the only one that thought he was a grouchy guy. His reputation was, this is a guy you would do well to avoid, and so we did. We avoided him. We made sure that our breaks didn't happen at the same time his breaks happened. He was labeled. He was tagged. He is the sourpuss guy. Avoid him. He is the angry guy. Stay away from him. And everybody did just that. We ignored him. We avoided him. We stayed away from him. And nobody really had anything to say at all to him or about him unless it was some passing derogatory dig. And this was true for everyone in the grocery store except the woman who worked the non-foods aisle. Now, the non-foods aisle has lots and lots of little tiny things that have to be taken care of, so she spent her whole job on that one aisle dealing with lots and lots of little tiny things. But she was a kind woman. Whenever someone said something derogatory about him, she defended him. Whenever it was time for a break, she would go out of her way to invite him to come and sit at the break table with her. She had figured out that there was more to this man than the curmudgeonness that he had been labeled in the store. And she was friendly to him, even though she was not friendly to her. Well, people who work in grocery stores spend hours and hours and hours together over the course of a year, stocking shelves side by side, stocking produce side by side, having all kinds of interactions around the break table. And inspired by this lady's superior labeling of this guy, I started to ask him questions when we would be standing near one another stacking cans on shelves. And after a while, well, at first he didn't answer me. After a while, he started to answer me, but he answered me in very short, grouchy terms. But I kept asking, and eventually he began to talk with me while we would stack cans. And I learned that his was a life of very difficult choices. He was a single dad working very hard to do right by his child. As a grocery clerk, he didn't make very much money, so there was never enough time because he had to work whenever he could. And he had to earn a living, and he had to be present with his child, and he was always having to make hard choices between where he would be at any given time. His life was organized on such a tight schedule that if his team didn't work to maximum efficiency to get the load stacked so that he could get out the door on time, he was late picking up his child, and he couldn't afford after-school care. And so consequently, his child suffered if he was late, and his life was a pressure cooker. Every time a load came in, he started the clock determining whether his child was going to be left alone at school or not. And so he was earning a living in a pressure cooking life. But none of the people, the 40 or 50 people who worked at that store, could see this label. They saw him as grouchy jerk working in grocery. They did not see him as harried dad trying to do right by his child. Now, the label grouchy jerk has a lot of power, and once it is assigned, the only logical response was avoidance and dismissal. However, had there been some superior effort given to naming, perhaps with a little more inquiry, a little more thought, the community might have assigned him the name Harried Dad Trying to Do His Best. And this label and this name might have invited a very different response than merely avoidance and giving a wide berth. This name might have invited understanding and patience and assistance and allowances being made. This label might have inspired the crew to make sure that they finished up the load, even the big loads, in time for him to pick up his child. This label could have inspired some creativity on the part of the team in order to give him his lunch late so that he could run and pick up his daughter and bring her back and sit her on the stacking table for the 45 minutes it took to bring everything to conclusion, which is what happened after the non-foods lady helped people understand what was going on. Any label once applied determines what's going to happen next. There's a great power in the labels that we assign to one another, and there's great power in the labels that we assign to ourselves. They determine what's going to happen next. We often create and assign those labels with very little thought, with very little inquiry. We usually do it in an instant, in a knee-jerk response to some kind of an emotional slight or some kind of an emotional hurt or something that tugs at one of the thing that goes on inside of us, some insult or some injury, often quite trivial. And when we do that, we do not give it our best thought. And when we come and assign that label, we make some very powerful determinations about what is going to happen next, and we do it without thinking much about it at all. And consequently, we shrink our worlds and we never even thought about it. Consequently, we shrink one another's worlds and we never even gave it much thought. These powerful, powerful consequences on the basis of something that was never considered very deeply. We paint one another with a single stripe and we create for ourselves and for one another worlds that we don't want to live in. And Jesus' words about power Jesus' words about loving enemy, Jesus' words about caring for neighbor, Jesus' words about caring for those who create adversity for us. These things make no sense. How could they? But when we come to reconsidering our labels, we end up finding the world we want to live in. So we do well to consider our labels deeply. But this is made all the worse because the very existence of labels goes counter to the wisdom of the ancients. At our deepest level, we are greater than any descriptive label that we can assign to ourselves or to one another. We are more than even the most majestic of labels that we could give one another because, as we've said in the past, we are made of God dust. Yes, our bodies and our brains are made of stardust. Everything that comes in the material world comes from the explosions of stars, and we are ultimately made of that same dirt. But we are also made of the divine. At the core, we are made of the same stuff God is made of. So any label, any name, will pale in its attempt to define us. No name is big enough to contain the divine image that was breathed into us, that indwells us. At our core, we are made of the indefinable. We are made of the incorruptible. We are made of the immortal. We are made of the infinite, because we are made of the same stuff God is made of. The very Spirit of God is put to dwell within us. The breath of God is at the center of who we are. The image of God defines the deepest and truest part of us. Under all the layers of illusion, under the layers of woundedness, under the layers of sinfulness, under the layers of all those things that cause us to behave badly, the truest and deepest part of us is made of the same indefinable, indescribable stuff that God is made of. And this puts the truest and deepest parts of us beyond the finitude of labels or names. Like God, in whose image we are made, our truest essence is ineffable. Like God, in whose image we are made, our truest essence is beyond the limits of that which can be put into words. Like God, in whose image we are made, our truest essence is beyond the limits of that which can be named, beyond the limits of that which can be talked about. Now, that's a really big truth. That is a transformative truth. And that is a truth that the ancient Christian mystics have been contemplating for millennia. And it might be a little difficult to get your brain around that, you know, what, like by noon. So consequently, let's say that we can't fully embrace the full implications of this existential reality that we are made in the very likeness and image of God. Let's say that we can't soak in the full implications of this truth. That's okay. You don't have to, especially when so much of life is spent fixing faucets and preparing meals and planning and executing how to get the car washed and how to pick up the laundry. But we shouldn't ignore this existential truth either, because it can at least, even if we can't get our brains fully around it, it can at least inspire us to do better at the labels that we do use. Because even if we can't get a hold of the transcendent nature that the image of God indwells the people that we walk this earth with, we can push ourselves to think more comprehensively about how we use those names, the names we give one to another, especially when we see how powerfully they determine what happens next, especially when we see how powerfully those names determine how we live our lives, and especially when we see how powerfully those labels will keep us from heeding the teachings of Jesus on how to use or misuse power. What we could do is we could allow this great existential truth to push us to not allow ourselves to name one another and ourselves so shallowly, so limitedly. We could work hard not to react with such knee-jerk foolishness, to not limit ourselves to defining one another with such ill-considered labels. The least we could do is take this great and noble truth and use it to inspire us to avoid the foolish use of labels, to not let them determine how we live. But at best, if we could do better, what we could do is we could meditate on the grandeur of the glory of God that indwells us now in this instant, in this moment. What we talked about during meditation this morning, that we could see that the glory of the Lord is in and around you at every moment, at every instant, and it is there to be found. And we could allow this sense of immortality and ineffability to overtake our vision and to overtake and sometimes trump the ordinary mode of seeing, to overtake the structures of thought that so limit our perceptions. This is what the ancient spiritual disciplines are designed to do. The ancient spiritual disciplines are designed to help us see a bigger reality. Over a lifetime of practice, these ancient spiritual disciplines change us. They elevate the plane of existence on which we are living. They change the eyes with which we see, so we see new things. They change the ears with which we hear, so we hear new things. So what we could do is we could begin to practice the ancient spiritual disciplines, and we could meditate on the texts as we did this morning. We could practice silent contemplation like the ancient practices of centering prayer. We could spend time in solitude even in the midst of our busy lives. We could stir up gratitude in our hearts. We could discipline ourselves to serve other people. We could reflect on our scriptures as we're going to do second week in July when we start looking at the book of John. And we could watch how these ancient disciplines begin to help us see our humanity in a purer, clearer, truer light. And then grasping this glimpse of the grandeur of the divine nature that is put within us, we could not, when we meet one another, compare labels to see how we stack up. We could, having seen this interior truth, not calculate who among us has the preferred descriptive label. We could not react with emotional superiority when we feel that we come out well in the comparison, or react with emotional insecurity when we think that someone else comes out with the preferred description. Because this well-worn path of labeling someone, relating to them through the label, and then limiting our interaction according to that label, this pattern creates human alienation. Because this well-worn path of labeling and then limiting the interactions, this creates human alienation. This is what causes the seedbed for the abuse of power that we've been talking about. And it is this that Jesus is trying to save us from. It is this that the teaching of Jesus is inviting us to live free of. So, with that, we conclude this lesson. We've talked about how important it is if we would not be abusers of power and misusers of a power according to the teachings of Jesus, how important it is to see ourselves as not as separated from one another as we intuitively tend to think. It's going to be important to see ourselves in circles of belonging that are actually much bigger than we intuitively feel they are. It's going to be important for us to exercise the moral imagination, even with those who are rivals or adversaries, the same kind of moral imagination we practice with friends, where we search through the database to find comparable realities. And it's going to be important, as we talked about today, to not limit one another through the practices of naming and labeling, and therefore reducing how we act and what happens next. These will keep us from heeding and hearing the teachings of Jesus. These will lock us into systems of power misuse and power abuse, and it will be this that Jesus seeks to save us from in our next lesson, where we begin to talk about a better way of using power, looking at the other teachings of Jesus that bring us to a superior way of relating to one another in light of bigger truths. So, Spirit of God, once again, I pray for us as a community to be users of power who build up and do not tear down, users of power who strengthen and do not weaken. I pray that that would be so, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.